Frank. We're going to be the panel that hears three cases today, but we'll look first to our 130 docket. The first case is Later versus Giles. Are counsel present? I assume that at counsel table, you're the folks for that?
Yes, sir.
And the second case for our 130 docket is Gordon versus Smith. Are both counsel here for that?
We are, Your Honor.
Yes, Your Honor.
All right, very good. Have all counsel in these two cases had an opportunity to review our one-page document that summarizes our procedures? Okay, everybody's nodding yes. We will start first with Later versus Giles. Do either of you folks have any questions about that document and about our procedures? Yes. All right. I would add one last thing before we begin, and that is if anyone has a pager or other electronic device that might go off and interrupt the lawyers or the court, please turn that either to vibrate or off. That being said, we're ready to begin with Later versus Childs.
Thank you, Your Honor. It pleases the court. My name is Jim Spoya, registration 17061, appearing for the appellant, Tom Giles. The company involved in this case, Center for Renewal, or as it's been appropriately acronymed, CFR, provided intensive outpatient group therapy for chemically dependent persons and for severely mentally disabled patients. The company was owned and managed by Ms. Later and Mr. Giles, equally 50% apiece. At various times during its existence, CFR had 7 locations in the Denver metro area and as many as 10 contracts with insurance companies. For the most part, Ms. Later and Mr. Giles did not provide the actual therapy. They were the ones who were supervising different therapists who were actually conducting the groups. CFR was a very successful company. In its highest earning year, it grossed over $400,000 with a net income of approximately $120,000. Now, as the court is aware, this case revolves around the dissolution of CFR and the handling of its assets and the value of those assets and their division between Ms. Later and Mr. Giles. This case was before the Court of Appeals previously, and in 2006, in its mandate in that previous proceeding, this court required the district court to do three things. First, it required it to conduct a hearing to determine whether the contracts and license have non-goodwill value. Second, if so, to determine the value attributed to each. And third, to divide that value between Mr. Giles and Ms. Later. With respect to the factual issue of whether the contracts and license have non-goodwill value, the court said, and I'm quoting here, "It is unclear from the record whether the license and insurance contracts constitute goodwill value. At first glance, the license and contracts do not appear to reflect common goodwill qualities such as name, location, and continuing patronage. Therefore, a hearing is necessary to determine that factual issue." These assets are necessary assets to the operations, or were necessary assets to the operations of CFR. As noted in my reply brief, the CFR was required by Colorado law to obtain a license from ADAD to conduct the mental health services, but it was also required to have the ADAD license in order to get the contracts from the insurance companies, so they were required. I would categorize these assets as not nice to have, but necessary to have in order to conduct the business that CFR was conducting in the manner in which it was conducting it, meaning that it was being paid through the insurance companies. And I think the evidence is clear that neither Mr. Giles nor Ms. Leader would have engaged in this company had it not been for their ability to obtain the insurance contracts. I think it's necessary to determine whether these assets have goodwill qualities of name, location, and assurance or expectation of continued public patronage to look at the actual assets themselves.
Pardon me, counsel, I'm sorry to interrupt, but didn't the prior division resolve that in this case when it concluded that they don't have goodwill value and thus the trial court had to look and see only if they had non-goodwill value, right?
That's correct. if you look at it that way, I think you could argue, well, if the goodwill portion of the company went away, then whatever residual value there is to these assets, by definition, would be non-goodwill value. We certainly took that position. In an abundance of caution, we, at trial, presented evidence that would allow the court to determine, specifically stripping everything else away, whether the license or the contracts have non-goodwill value. In other words, this court, in its prior mandate, identified the attributes of goodwill, and we, basically out of not knowing how else to do it, tried to determine, is there a connection between the goodwill as identified by the court in its mandate and these assets, the license and the contract?
Let's assume for the purposes of the following question that the issue of goodwill is off the table because it's law of the case. These assets don't have goodwill value.
Correct.
Let's turn next to the valuation method that was applied by the court, net asset value. Your argument is that the court did not apply the proper test.
Correct.
Would you explain that to me, please?
Sure. The district court, if you read the district court's opinion, it's clear that their determination that these assets had no value other than $100 license fee for the ADAT license rests on the fact that the court determined that neither the ADAT license, that the ADAT license could not be transferred to a third party, and that the actual transfer to Ms. Lader's new company was, I think the language that the court used was questionable about the decision that ADAT made there. So their decision about the ADAT license had to do with the fact that they didn't believe that it was a transferable license, even though it had actually been transferred to Ms. Lader's company. And with respect to the insurance contracts, the court determined that the ability to have those contracts transferred to Ms. Lader's new company, which they were, rests in the fact that Ms. Lader had some type of special relationship with the insurance companies, and that the insurance companies, I think that the language that the court used was expressed a desire to work with her. So they were implying some type of special relationship between Ms. Lader and the insurance companies.
Does the record contain any information that either ADAD or the insurance companies turned Mr. Giles down for either a license or for other referral contracts, or that they would have done so if he had applied?
No, and with respect to the insurance contracts, there was evidence that Mr. Giles, a company that he was involved with, had different insurance contracts, so there was no evidence that he would have been turned down. And with respect to the ADAT license, again, there was no evidence of that either. But that begs the question, if he had been able to obtain a new license and new contracts, would they have had the same value? Would they have had value at that time at all if he were able to obtain those? And would that value have been the same value as the existing ADAT license and insurance contracts?
Is there any evidence in the record that the contracts had any uniquely desirable terms, if the license has some sort of uniquely desirable terms and conditions distinct from other companies providing the same types of services?
With respect to the insurance contracts, they're unique licenses. They're individually negotiated, the rates are negotiated, and the services are negotiated between the provider and the insurance company. But
my question is not whether are they desirable? Are they better terms than anybody else could get, or than other companies similarly situated were getting? Is there any evidence in the record on that?
What made them unique is the fact that they're called IOP contracts. And Mr. Giles testified through his knowledge of the IOP contracts that the insurance companies are very protective of the IOP providers, and he didn't believe that he would be able to obtain those types of contracts for the areas that were being serviced through CFR. You'd have to read through his testimony in trial, but Mr. Giles was the executive director of Cigna Behavioral Health prior to being involved in CFR, and he understands how those contracts work. And it was his opinion that once someone else has those contracts, they're going to be protected in difficult to define ways by the insurance companies. So that's the uniqueness of the insurance contracts.
So there were no other companies in the Denver metropolitan area providing these services that had similar contracts? Is there evidence on that question?
There were other providers, but there weren't other providers like CFR. I believe, I'm going a bit from memory here, that may be faulty on this, but I believe that the other providers that were in competition with CFR were larger organizations, hospitals, and the like. And there was testimony by Mr. Giles that the protection that's afforded to the IOPs, the smaller companies, by the insurance companies had to do with the fact that they had a little more control over those companies than they do over larger institutions. So that was the uniqueness of that situation. Given the fact that the insurance companies exercised that protectiveness over those companies, it did give it more value than what he might have been able to obtain himself.
And is that the basis for the value that Mr. Giles ascribed to those assets, or his expert?
I'm sorry?
Is that the basis for the value that was ascribed to those assets by Mr. Giles' expert?
Well, the valuation method was not, I'm not quite sure I can answer your question in the way that you're looking for. The method of valuing, meaning coming up with the actual value,
if these contracts were better than other contracts could get, presumably there would be a value to them. It would be a fair market value. So
right.
You would pay for them. And was there any evidence as to what that value was?
Well, when you say fair market value, again, this goes to my disagreement with the district court about how they applied that. The district court looked at whether the insurance, the contract and the license could actually be sold, could be transferred to a third party. And I don't believe that that's necessary, that you have to reach that conclusion in order to determine that the license and contracts have value, whether it could be sold to another party. I don't think that's what this court required the district court to do.
But my question was there any evidence of what that value was attributable to the unique provision you're describing?
I don't believe that was, that particular aspect of the contract was looked at by the valuation expert.
Thank
Hope
you.
That answered your question. What you raise, Judge Miller, is a good point about the nature of the contracts and the license. I think it's very important to understand what the nature of these assets are because of the fact that the district court appeared to assume or surmise that that this company was just private practices engaged in by Ms. Leder and Mr. Giles, which is not the case at all. If you look through their opinion, the district court's opinion, it's pretty clear that they're looking at this simply as a separation of practices, such as attorneys separating practices or doctors and that and the like. This is not the case at all. The company was run with assets that were generated by the work of both Ms. Leder and Mr. Giles, and that those assets had separate value away from the goodwill of the company. And I'll reserve the rest of my time.
Thank you, counsel. You've got about 2 minutes and 37 seconds.
Good afternoon. Joel Russman, appearing on behalf of Lois Leder. There were three issues at the trial of this case. First one, which has already been broached, was the non-goodwill value of the contracts and the license. The second was a breach of fiduciary duty claim that was raised after the remand of this case last time, pursuant to which Mr. Giles claimed that Ms. Leder had breached her fiduciary duty with respect to the liquidation of Renewal and the contracts and the licenses specifically. Judge Hagelin found there was no breach of fiduciary duty, and that issue is not being appealed. The third one had to do with the prevailing party for purposes of an attorney's fees provision. On the remand of this case, the last time this was here, Judge Gilman had declined to award attorney's fees, And this court held that this was a mandatory fee-shifting provision and directed the trial court to determine who the prevailing party was for purposes of attorney's fees. Judge Haglund found that Ms. Leader had not breached her fiduciary duty, that she was the prevailing party, did award her attorney's fees, and one of the issues under appeal today is an allocation of those attorney's fees to the extent that they're allocable to the defense by Ms. Leader of the failed breach of fiduciary duty claim. I would like to actually spend my time on the same issues that this court raised questions about, those being the valuation questions. I believe that the other issues raised on appeal were either properly handled by Judge Haglund, were irrelevant to any of the matters either before the trial court. And unless I have any time left, I'd like to stick also to the valuation questions. Mr. Giles identified three issues with respect to the valuation of these assets, and he notes that they are questions of law and questions of fact. To the extent that this is a question of law, he has identified the standard of valuation to be applied as being the appropriate question of law. There are cases in Colorado, there's established case law, that the value of an asset of a corporation is its fair market value. Two cases that we cited in the briefs, and those were also discussed by Mr. Giles, are the Van Skoek v. Van Skoek Holdings case and the Walter S. Cheeseman Realty Company v. Moore. Both of these cases involve closely held corporations that primarily owned real estate and secondarily owned securities. In both cases, there were minority shareholders who wished to get cashed out. And in both cases, the value of the stock of those companies became an issue. One involved the fiduciary duty claim, one of them involved the dissenting shareholder claim, but in both cases, the question came down to how do we value the shares of stock in this company? And in both cases, the Court of Appeals ended up in a two-step process. The first step in that process of valuing the shares was to determine the standard of valuation. And both cases, the courts used the same language. They referred to these as value factors. They said, let's look at value factors. And they identify three value factors, which we are calling standards of valuation. One of them is net asset value. One of them is the earnings or investment value of the shares. And the third one is the fair market value of the shares. The Court of Appeals in both cases said, what you must do is look at the relevant value factors, each of these methods of valuing the stock, and decide which is the most pertinent under the facts of this case. So step one was to go through and decide which of those were the most pertinent. And in both of those cases, the courts held that net asset value was the method to use. Second step, now that we have to use the net asset value, let's look at the value of the assets of these companies, which puts those cases on par with exactly what Judge Haglund had to look at. What is the value of these assets, these three insurance contracts, and this ADAT license? In both of those cases, Van Skoek and Cheeseman Realty, the courts held that the proper measure of value of the stocks is fair market value. Van Skoek said it. Cheeseman Realty said it. Cheeseman Realty actually said it twice. What they said was, net asset value is the share which a dissenter's stock represents in the value of the net assets of the corporation. It represents a judgment as to the fair market value of the assets based on the price that would be agreed upon by a willing seller and willing buyer under no compulsion to sell or buy. Two paragraphs later, the court says, as we have stated above, the value of a corporate asset is its fair market value. We lawyers rejoice when we get plain statements of the law like that, but they don't equivocate. They don't say under the facts of this case it's fair market value. They don't say under these circumstances. They say specifically that the value of a corporate asset is its fair market value.
Pardon me, Mr. Russman, for interrupting, but yes. Don't they also add that in the Cheeseman case, that in that case it was particularly pertinent to use net asset value because the entire corporation was being liquidated?
They do make that point, and I think the point ties in also to our case, because when you're liquidating a corporation, there are no goodwill factors anymore. We're liquidating them. We're trying to find the specific value of the assets. In both cases, there was no fair market value. So yes, that would Well, that would actually support what this court said before, which is go back in the case of the dissolved corporation and find out the value just of those assets because it's being dissolved. So yes, in both cases, they said fair market value is the appropriate measure of value of an asset of a corporation. No cases have been cited, I certainly couldn't find any, that have held otherwise, that have held that the value of an asset is measured any way other than fair market value. Instead, we have an argument from Mr. Giles that, as I looked through it and tried to parse it, it appeared that what he's doing is taking, looking at the brief, taking the language relevant value factors, which the Court of Appeals in both cases used to refer to market value, net asset value, and so on. He takes those and drops them down into the second half of this analysis, which is the valuation of the assets, not the stock. Now note, in both cases, the courts never use the term relevant value factors with respect to the assets, only with respect to the shares. He then also changes the meaning of relevant value factors, ascribes it a new meaning, and completely ignores the fact that we have clear language that says the value of an asset is its fair market value.
Well, Mr. Russman, to be fair, doesn't the court in Cheeseman say, well, what a trial court should do is look at these different factors under the pertinent facts of the case, figure out which is the appropriate factor or factors, and then the court can give as much or as little weight to it as the evidence convinces the court to give, right?
That is exactly what it said. And it said that with respect to the valuation of the shares of stock. And if one stops to think about the valuing the shares, which is the company as a whole versus the assets, they're treated differently. And I believe that's why the courts in both cases held that when you're valuing the stock, there may be a market for that stock. It could be listed on the New York Stock Exchange. But there are different factors in valuing the stock than valuing the assets. So there is no established case law that says that those value factors should be applied to a valuation of assets. All of the language in Cheeseman and Van Scott refers to the valuation of the shares. Now, I made this a motion before Judge Haglund, before the trial started, exactly to this effect. I requested that he rule that as a matter of law, the value of these assets was fair market value. And he declined to so rule. He allowed Mr. Giles to put on evidence. I thought it would save us time in trial, but he allowed Mr. Giles to put on evidence of what they termed investment value. One was the relief from royalty approach, the other was the time saved approach, but he let them put on that evidence. And at the end, Judge Haglund held, as this court knows, that the $200 license was worth $200 and that the contracts were worth nothing. And the language that he used in his findings of fact, conclusions of law, was this. The court agrees with plaintiff's position that under the circumstances of this case, the proper standard for determining whether the contracts in question held non-goodwill values is that of fair market value of the individual asset, not investment value or valuation in the context of a going concern, because there had been evidence of the going concernness as well. And he cited Cheeseman Realty and he cited Van Scott. Thus, although I believed and still do that to the extent this is a question of law, the standard of law is clear that it is fair market value, Judge Haglund looked at it apparently from a factual point of view. And he weighed the evidence. He listened to evidence of fair market value. He listened to evidence of investment value, value as a going concern. And he said, to the extent that this is a question of fact, I find under the circumstances of this case that fair market value is to be applied. So we have the law and we have the facts. And as this court is well aware, the standard of review for questions of fact is abuse of discretion, which means that they will not be disturbed unless there is no support in the record. We submit to the court that there is plenty of support in the record for a finding that fair market value is appropriate. He listened to experts on both sides. He looked at the law, and that there's evidence for the finding that there was a zero value to the contracts and that there was a $200 value to the license. It seems that the court is presented with two fairly clear-cut choices here. One of them is to ignore the existing law as it's stated in Cheeseman Realty and also in Van Scott and hold, as the court is being urged, that investment value as a matter of law is what's to be applied here. I believe that's what's being urged on this court by Mr. Giles. The second thing is that he's urging this court to substitute itself for the trial court as far as listening to the evidence, as far as examining the documents, as far as listening to the testimony of people from the insurance companies, the lady from ADAD, listening to the experts, and to mandate that the trial court throw out fair market value, throw out the zero value or $200 value, and instead put in additional $18,000, $16,000, the numbers that he has urged. We would urge this court to adhere to established existing Colorado law as set forth in Cheeseman Realty, to acknowledge that there was sufficient evidence before Judge Haglin from which he could determine, to the extent that it's a question of law, that fair market value is appropriate in this case, not the others, and also to otherwise affirm his opinion and to send this back for a supplemental award of attorney's fees in conjunction with the appeal of this case, pursuant to the shareholder agreement and the prior ruling of this court. I see that I have a few minutes left. If there are any questions, I'd be happy to answer them. Otherwise, I'm finished.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Mr. Spoyer, you've got, I hope I'm pronouncing your name correctly.
Yes, sir.
You've got 2 minutes and 37 seconds.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Yes, sir.
The Cheeseman case, I'd like to read a quote from it. Proper determination, this is with respect to the valuation of the assets of the corporation. A proper determination will depend upon the particular circumstances of the corporation involved. The court must consider all relevant value factors, the most important of which are market value, investment value, or earning value. Investment value is the standard of value used by Mr. Giles' expert to make her determination of the value of the assets. And I want to talk for just with a couple minutes I have left about the application of fair market value by the district court, because it appears to me that the district court rested its determination of zero value or $100 of value based on its determination of the transferability or lack of transferability of those assets. The ADAD license was transferred to Ms. Leader's company, so saying that it has no value because it was not transferable is not accurate at all. There was some question about its transferability that was raised at the district court level, but Ms. Wells, who is the representative of ADAD, who is responsible for determining whether the license should be transferred or not, in her testimony, if you read it, she's very concerned about whether the license could be sold, not whether it could be transferred or not. So what the court was focusing on was the transferability to a third party, not to Ms. Leader. And that has no impact, should have no impact on the value of the asset. It certainly
measuring, excuse me, counsel, if you're measuring fair market value, wouldn't saleability be the relevant factor?
Well, I draw a distinction between saleability and transferability. If the license was not transferable at all, either to Ms. Leader's new company or anyone at all, I would agree it has zero value. Because if you can't transfer it, then you can't extract that value. But that's not the case. First of all, it was transferred to Ms. Leader's company. Second of all, the court even found that there's nothing underhanded about that transaction at all. It specifically found in the court's opinion that Ms. Leader had not made any misrepresentations to ADAD. Ms. Wells, who approved the transfer, knew all the relevant facts, and she approved the transfer. If you look at it from ADAD's perspective, they're trying to make sure that there are providers out there who can provide the services that those companies are to provide to the public. So from her perspective, Ms. Wells' perspective of ADAD, she did what she was supposed to be doing, making sure there are providers out there to provide those services. She was concerned about saleability, and I don't believe those two are interchangeable terms. If it's transferable, it certainly has value to the person who was being transferred to. And I should note too that even Ms. Leader's expert, Mr. Pontiff, said that in determining fair market value, you can have a pool of transferees or a market of one that does not invalidate the test of fair market value.
Thank you, counsel. Your time is up.
Great. Thank you.
Counsel, thank you very much for your arguments today. The case will stand submitted, and an opinion will issue in due course. thank you again for attending, and we will rearrange for the next argument.